Hello. Welcome to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and this is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. We're broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory on the University of British Columbia campus. And I hope that you are having a good beginning of the week. I hope everyone listening survived the storm in Vancouver. And today we are speaking with Alana Pochuk. Welcome to the show, Alana.
Thank you so much, Marie. Glad to be here.
Thanks for being with me. And so today we are speaking about the Welfare Food Challenge. And before we start that, I always want to start out with a bit of an intention for this show. So if you're in a place that's safe to do so, feel free to close your eyes. If you're driving or doing anything that needs your eyes open, please keep them open. But just I'm going to ask you to take a moment to focus on your breath. And just imagine that that breath is moving into your heart. And with every breath that you breathe into your heart, the energy around your heart gets a little bit bigger. And your heart just opens a little bit wider. And today for this hour, we're going to be talking about the Welfare Food Challenge, and I just want us to have an intention of love and abundance for all people on this planet who are living in poverty and in struggle, because there's more than enough for all of us here on this planet, and I just want us to remember that and to have open hearts and love and compassion for the people who are not as blessed as so many of us are. And I also, before we get into the discussion, I know we have, this is a global show because of the magical interwebs and YouTube, and I know that there are people who listen from countries where $610 a month is a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
So I do want to be respectful to people who are living in beyond extreme poverty. Maybe they're not listening on the internet, but I'm sure that we all are aware of people who are living without health care. In BC, we are so blessed to have such a wealth of resources, even people who are living in poverty have access to more than people in many other countries. But right now, today, we are speaking about a very real issue. People on welfare living in this province struggling to live far, far beyond the poverty line. And Alana is committed to, well, maybe I'll just let Alana talk about it. What
Thanks,
is this?
Marie. Well, yeah, $610 a month, as you said, really, like by Vancouver standards, does not stretch far. We know that the cheapest available housing is single room occupancy hotels in the downtown east side. For those who don't know, those are like tiny hotel spaces and don't usually include a bathroom. You can cook on a hot plate if you're lucky, sort of thing. And those run an average of $479 a month. So deduct that from $610 and you're looking at a pretty grim situation. And although you're right, we do have a public healthcare system and that's fantastic, the health impacts of living this way and having such inadequate access to food and having to do all kinds of things to survive that people might not otherwise choose do lead to health consequences and shorten lifespan by about 10 years for folks living in poverty compared to others. So it's pretty significant. So yeah, thanks so much for having me on the show.
No, thanks for taking part in the food challenge. And also, if you are on Twitter, so are we. And yeah, so you can tweet us with the hashtag Welfare Food Challenge, and we're going to try and read some of those out if you are listening live. And Alana, you also have a website, a blog.
I do, yes. That one is Alana's Food Challenge, and my name is spelled A-L-A-N-A, so it's A-L-A-N-A-S, foodchallenge.wordpress.com. So I'm posting pretty much daily about what this has been like for me. Really eye-opening, lots of challenging and surprising experiences and how that connects to the reality of food insecurity in our province for so many people.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, there is food insecurity just for, like, with this storm we had over the weekend. There was, I shop at Safeway, mm-hmm. and there was a power outage in their main warehouse, so they weren't able to ship any produce that day. So just one day without a delivery, mm-hmm. and things start to get empty. So even people who are financially secure, we are so dependent on things that we ship in. We can't just go out into, many of us don't have backyards with gardens.
Yeah, definitely not if you're living in an SRO on the downtown east side. That's going to be mm-hmm. super out of reach. And that's a good point about power outages and that sort of thing. Like if you have a fridge and all your food spoils because of a power outage, well, you're in a much more precarious situation as a person who might have already spent your entire food budget for the month than a person who can just, you know, go out and buy some canned goods or whatever it may be to cover those losses if that should happen.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned in your blog that you like to stock up on food.
I do. It makes me feel so secure and comfy. So on my blog, I have a picture of my bedroom floor that's like stacked with a crate, like big boxes of soy milk and organic lentil soup from Costco, because I just really like to stockpile. It makes me feel so secure. And so it is definitely challenging for me to know that I'm not able to do that. And I have pretty much precisely the amount of food I need to get through the week. And that's only in terms of calories. And that's only because I did some rather obsessive and anxious calculations to make sure I could get 2,000 calories a day. But certainly nobody can eat on $18 a week and nourish themselves properly in terms of all the nutrients that we need for our health. When you're looking at getting your calories in a day, it's sort of empty calories. So I've been eating like a lot of white rice and sort of suffering the consequences on my blood sugar and that kind of thing. So, yeah, super challenging.
So is the white rice because whole grain rice was too costly?
Way too costly. That's right. Yeah. So what I ended up doing is creating a spreadsheet, actually, to keep track of the amount I was spending on food and also the calorie content of the food. And I recognize most people wouldn't do that. A lot of people don't have the privilege of so much time, especially like single moms who are caring for kids, or, you know, they don't have access to a computer that has like a spreadsheet program on it and like the internet and all those things to do the research. But I just did that because otherwise the anxiety would be like too great for me and I wouldn't be able to do the challenge at all. And so the sorts of decisions I had to make, for example, is like I bought a bag of black beans as well as like a small amount of brown rice from bulk. But then when I crunched the numbers, I realized those were like way outside my budget because the dried black beans were 400 grams in a package. And I found some split peas that were 907 grams in a package and they were quite similar in price. So clearly I couldn't afford to have both. And also be able to buy any kind of fruit and vegetables at all. So I opted for the split peas, and I had just decided to fill in the rest of the calorie shortfall with white rice from the dollar store, which, by the way, is very different from other white rice. It's quite kind of gummy. It doesn't cook up very well.
Is that real rice, or is that the reconstituted?
Well, it's not. It's a parboiled rice. So I'm not really sure. It takes about 20 minutes to cook. It's white rice, $1.25 per kilo. But I just want to flag, you know, like what I did, buying something and realizing I couldn't use it and setting it aside is something that people on welfare could never do, right? Like you can't just overshop or like kind of have a, oh, well, I'll just pick this up now and kind of like figure out whether I can afford it later. I can do that because this is just a kind of exercise for me. It's a very safe thing to do. It's not my life. But yeah, even that privilege of like setting aside the things that are too expensive, I wouldn't have if this were a real situation, not just sort of a thought experiment for me.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like in the preparation for it, you've almost already kind of broken a little bit of the rules, or?
Well, I don't know. I mean, yeah, that's an interesting question. The rules are to not accept any free things, to not eat food you've grown, you know, recognizing, as I said, like people who live in poverty, especially in urban settings like Vancouver, don't get to garden, obviously. And charity is, a terrible way to have to get your food, for one thing, like really disempowering and dehumanizing that power dynamic. and also so inconsistent, right? It's totally unreliable. You can't rely on a stroke of luck to meet one of your most basic human needs. So it makes a lot of sense that those are the rules. Now, I don't know what the other rules, I mean, the other rules I'm sort of like thinking of in my mind, right? Like I'm like using a freezer, I'm using a blender. Those are things that people on welfare often can't access, but they're not part of the official rules of the challenge. So I think I'm following the rules of the challenge to the letter, but just sort of thinking in my mind of how I'm breaking the rules of everyday life for a person who's actually on income assistance in BC.
Wow. So I'm curious, I don't know how you have some statistics there on your phone as well. So you mentioned single room occupancy in the downtown east side is about 479. Now that's if you're fortunate enough to have that, because I imagine they're quite full.
Yeah, I would imagine so too. I'm not sure what the vacancy rate is.
Yeah, and a lot of them I know have been remodeled and they're being rented out for quite higher prices to students.
Right, and there's all kinds of gentrification happening in the downtown east side and condos going up and people being displaced. So you're right. That's why I think the prices keep spiraling out of control. Welfare rates haven't gone up in 9 years. Meanwhile, the cost of living, as we all know in Vancouver, is really skyrocketing, and in particular rents. And I've even seen that in my own life. And of course, the impacts are so much more dramatic and severe for people who are kind of just getting by or not actually getting by at all.
So I'm curious if you have the breakdown of why it's $18 a week, because I can imagine in this city, I mean, even I look for places and kind of see what's out there, and even a room in a shared apartment or shared house, you're lucky to get it for $600 or less.
Exactly.
So I mean, I imagine there
are utilities often.
Yeah. I imagine there are a lot of people living on welfare who are paying all of their check towards rent.
Right. Yeah. And then people get into situations like survival sex work or, you know, cycling in and out of abusive relationships and all those sorts of really dangerous situations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you wanted to know the breakdown. So first of all, I should just give credit to Raise the Rates BC for being the organizers of this welfare food challenge. So you can go to raisetherates.org to learn more about them. And also the official website of the challenge is welfarefoodchallenge.org. So these figures come from the calculations that Raise the Rates did. And I know that this is based on research, like the Carnegie Action Project researches the costs of SROs in the downtown east side and keeps track of how they're changing year by year. So this is sort of the most current information we have. That the average cost of an SRO is $479, and by the way, the city of Vancouver also acknowledges that that is the average. Damage deposit for $20, cell phone necessary to look for work, right? $25 a month. That's a very optimistic estimate, obviously not including a data plan or anything like that. Personal hygiene and laundry at just $10 a month. So that adds up to $534, leaving $76 a month left for food. What this does not include is anything for transportation. So no bus tickets. You have to walk everywhere, which, as you can imagine, if you're not eating properly and your health is suffering, is extremely difficult. What are folks on disability who have disabilities supposed to do if walking is an issue for them? Or you can rely on just hoping that bus drivers will let you onto the bus and you won't get inspected for your ticket, which a lot of people do. And if you do, there's a $173 fine. So that's pretty significant. And of course, there's nothing for clothing, haircuts, any kind of social life, any kind of treats, and the things that we all need to kind of feel human and happy and alive in life. And then, so yeah, the $18 a week comes from dividing 76 per month by, I guess, the number of days in a month and days in a week to come up with $18 per week.
Thank you. Well, we just have, we have a treat here, a tweet here from Jayco_62. And this person says, try talking to real people on welfare and see what they say. I live on $40 a month. $60 a month is luxurious.
Exactly.
So, and I believe we did, this all was thrown together quite short notice. We did try to get someone who is on welfare.
That's a great point. Yeah. So I did contact contact one of the organizers for Raise the Rates to suggest having a person who lives the welfare food challenge nonstop and can't, you know, it's not a, not a, an experiment, not just an exercise for them, to be on the show. And I was basically told that, like, it's so difficult to communicate, like, to read, like, we do, there are lots of people who are involved in organizing with the Raise the Rates, but you can't really reach them by email or phone usually. And even bus fare to come out to UBC would be a real barrier. So,
yeah, that would be $2.75 each way because we'd be here long enough. A transfer only lasts 90 minutes, right?
Exactly. So again, it would be like dicey. You'd have to hope that the bus driver would let you on and you wouldn't get inspected for your ticket.
Yeah.
So yeah, thanks for flagging that. Yeah, it would have been for sure preferable to have someone speak to their real life experiences rather than just this thing that I'm going through, which of course can't at all approximate what it's really like for people.
Absolutely. And of course, if JCO62 is listening, feel free to tweet more. I have a feeling this person may have just read it on Twitter. But if you are listening live on the radio, feel free to tweet. You can tweet me at Marie Bernard or just use the hashtag Welfare Food Challenge, and I will be checking it regularly throughout the show. So it is time for a break. This is Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. We are speaking right now with Alana Prochuk. She is participating voluntarily in the Welfare Food Challenge on social media. That's hashtag Welfare Food Challenge. And you can go to raisetherates.org if you'd like more information about that. And Alana also has alanasfoodchallenge.wordpress.com if you'd like to see her blog. And we'll be back with more synchronicity in just a moment.
It's the biggest musical competition in the country.
CITR is hosting our 33rd annual Shindig. It's a battle of the bands at Pat's Pub every Tuesday night.
We've curated 27 delicious local bands to compete for the title.
Who will take the crown from last year's winners late spring? Come to find out. Fun fact, at this year's Shindig, there'll be fun facts for beers.
Oh, and jokes too.
Thanks to this year's sponsors, AMS Events, Backline Musician Services, Canadian Music Week, Discorder Magazine, Vader Master Studios, Four Winds Brewery, Rain City Records, Mint Records, Music Waste, Nimbus Recording, Thunderbird Radio Hell, Six Cent Press, Silver Fox Postering, Minuteman Press, Band Merch Canada, Blue Light Studios, and Zulu Records.
Come out to see Shindig this week, October 18th, to see Pavel, Future Star, and Wind Up Birds.
Good night, Shindig is everywhere. Remember, no matter what anyone says, rock on!
AMS Food Bank. Your access to money during the studies at UBC will most likely be limited, but it is a priority of the AMS Food Bank to ensure your access to food is not. The AMS Food Bank provides emergency food relief 7 days a week for all UBC students. To volunteer with the food bank or for inquiries about how to take advantage of the services provided, contact them at foodbank@ams.ubc.ca. For more information, find the AMS Food Bank on Facebook or feel free to visit anytime across from the Wellness Center and Sprouts.
This month's issue of Discorder is purple. And you know, purple is the new green with envy.
Violet! You're turning violet!
The October issue features interviews with Puzzlehead, Swim Team, Typlant, and Poxy Sun on their new and upcoming movie. We address the uncertainty of the Trans-Pacific Partnership for Artists and sit down with the organizers of Japanese Poets North of the 49th to discuss reconciliation through poetry. It's your
birthday. Thanks to this month's sponsors, Vinyl Records, Recruiting Canada, the Rickshaw Theatre, Fringe Festival, Zipcar, Jazz Records, the Astoria, the UBC AMS, Don't Argue, Redgate, Print, SFU Community Engagement, Live Van, the Vancouver Art Book Fair, the Rio Theatre, the Vancouver International Film Festival, Vancouver New Music, and Timber Concerts. Pick up a free physical copy of Discorder around town or read online at discorder.ca.
We gonna ride around the city, I'm gonna make your night. Eat your cake, bake you off a...
Welcome back to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm Marie Bernard, and we are joined right now with Alana Prochuk. She is a voluntary participant in the Welfare Food Challenge, and we're trying to highlight how, obviously, people who are on welfare benefits are not voluntary, voluntarily living on $18 a week. So I'm curious, Alana, why is this so important to you personally?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I got interested in doing something to change systems more. You know, like we live in a society that's really not set up in a fair way. Policies aren't fair, laws aren't fair, and institutions also really aren't fair. And people suffer really different kinds of consequences from that, depending on their life circumstances and who they are, and sort of the injustice that they might have experienced. So looking at poverty statistics, we know that Indigenous people are hugely overrepresented among folks living in poverty. About 40% of Indigenous people live in poverty nationwide, is what I heard at the press conference yesterday, and about 50% of kids living on reserve as well, so that's really high. Also women, folks with disabilities, newcomers, racialized people. So, you know, it's a problem that goes really deep in our society. It's deeply rooted. And for a long time, I'd been a volunteer. So I think that's still super important, like helping out with different kinds of programs. And in fact, I just started volunteering with at a residence for seniors. And, you know, that's great. But also I wanted to do something a bit more political to try to create deeper change, which I think can have greater impacts, even though sometimes it's harder to feel like you are having an impact because you work and work and this change is very incremental and slow. And sometimes, like with the Welfare Food Challenge now in its fifth year, we haven't seen progress yet, but we're sure hoping to see something with the provincial election coming up and possibly some policy changes just around the corner. We sure hope. By the way, I'll just mention now before I forget, there is a petition on the RaiseTheRates.org website about increasing disability and income assistance rates. So we hope that you'll all add your voice to that. So a bit about how I got involved. With this in mind, that I wanted to kind of contribute to something at a more sort of system level, I contacted Raise the Rates because I'd been aware of their work for a while and really admired what they were doing and the way they do it. You know, it's very kind of theatrical. They've done some interesting like street performance and attention grabbing, like the Welfare Food Challenge, I think really gets people talking. And I like things like that, that, you know, just spark conversations and are quite creative and attention grabbing. And I asked how I could get involved. And so I started attending a few of their meetings and being involved in like very tiny ways, like taking minutes at occasional meetings. And Raise the Rates is led primarily by people who have lived experience living in poverty or are currently on disability or income assistance. So I felt good about kind of taking direction from them and like that this Welfare Food Challenge was an idea that that people who actually have firsthand experience came up with. So I felt like, okay, as a person who hasn't ever experienced poverty, who's always had more than enough to get by, this is a good way for me to contribute because, you know, I wouldn't know where to begin myself. So I want to kind of go with the expertise and vision of people who really know their stuff. And in terms of why food is really important to me, I'm very kind of, as you pointed out earlier, very attached to my food. And I feel really secure when I have food and I feel really insecure when I don't. And one of the things I blog about, if you check out my alanasfoodchallenge.wordpress.com, is the impact of having had an eating disorder and my relationship to food. And although I've never been financially insecure, I have experienced hunger and what it can do to a person. So I know how terrible it is to feel exhausted, depressed, anxious, antisocial, and just to be absolutely, to have your entire life absorbed by obsession with food, which is actually like a completely normal and quite universal human reaction to hunger, which has been demonstrated by research. And it just like narrows your world. Like you have no capacity really to do anything else. So it's just obscene that we expect people to look for work and to find work and find a way to change their situation when there's so many systems that are completely working against them. And the impacts of hunger mean that it's like really super difficult to do that. And in my own life, being able to nourish myself is a sign that I value myself, right? Mm-hmm. It's like this is such a fundamental human need. It's such a fundamental human right. So if you aren't eating voluntarily, I guess, it's like it's a way to not value yourself. And if society isn't set up in a way that allows you to eat, it's a way for society to show you you're not really valued. So to me, not allowing people to have food is just so unacceptable and dehumanizing and unjust on every level. And it is a very personal issue for me, even though I've never been in this situation of having to scrape by financially or apply for welfare or disability. And by the way, of people who do apply, about 50% get declined. And the process to apply is like really outrageous too. It's 90 online pages to fill out. So imagine
you have to have access to a computer or go to the library.
Yeah, you have to find a computer. What if you don't speak English as a first language? What if you don't read print? What if you have some disability that means that you can't look at a computer screen and read what's on there? Whatever. They really put a lot of barriers in place to even accessing these benefits in the first place, which are quite inadequate, as we've seen. I've also heard that the average wait time for folks phoning to inquire about benefits is approximately the same time that the phone call will automatically time out. So a huge number of people actually just get disconnected because they're waiting so long on the line.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, huge problems with the systems in our society. So it's just my hope that making this issue so public by people who have not been on income assistance or disability and whose friends largely have not experienced poverty. I mean, obviously we all have friends and family members who have, or most of us. But I would say most people in my circle haven't had this experience firsthand. So it is great to get those people to try to raise awareness because, it's just a matter of political will. This situation doesn't need to continue this way. Poverty is a policy decision, essentially, and the loss of life that occurs because of it also is completely preventable. So it's, people who maybe aren't clued in now and who do have more financial privilege and perhaps more political influence mm-hmm. can force this change, I really believe.
Well, I can say that myself, I have experienced this kind of thing firsthand. Mm-hmm. Poverty. My mother was on welfare and disability, lived on the downtown east side. I know, I remember when I was about, because I went into foster care around age four, but I remember prior to that, if I spilt a glass of milk, mm-hmm. like I literally would cry because I knew how poor we were.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, and what a loss that was.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, and honestly, I have to say that I've kind of been pushing to get out of this poverty and never look back, And I'm so grateful that there are people who really do see the value in helping people and helping people up. I am curious, and again, if you are on Twitter, you can use the hashtag Welfare Food Challenge, or you can tweet me at Marie Bernard on Twitter, and we will read out your post. There was someone who posted and said that we should invite someone who is on welfare, and we did make that effort,
yeah.
But due to difficulties getting in touch with someone who has such limited income and is not able to access a telephone or a computer for email or even to purchase bus fare to UBC and back. It is a huge barrier, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am curious, though, you wanted to say something?
Oh, I just wanted to say the response I got when I emailed suggesting this was that because it is so difficult for folks who like this is their daily life, that Raise the Rates tends to try to make sure that they can always be at major media events. Not this is very major for me, Marie, and for both of us and all our listeners, I know. But there was a press conference yesterday that CTV Vancouver was at and Francophone CBC, and I don't know how many other organizations, but there were some folks who are in disability benefits and do experience poverty firsthand, who shared some of their stories and who were quoted in the media. And I believe if you Google just take a look online for that press conference, you might be able to see some interview footage with those folks sharing their amazing insights and firsthand expertise about what needs to change.
So what is, if you know this, what is RaiseTheRates.org suggesting as a minimum level of income for someone?
Yeah, so they're suggesting the market basket measure. So there are different ways of measuring poverty, some of which are like quite difficult to understand and explain. But the market basket measure is one that's unique in that it's based on what things actually cost in whatever environment you happen to be living in. So it's basically a basket of goods that are considered essential for everybody. Nothing fancy, just, you know, rent, food, and like transportation, all the things that we all need to get by and what they actually cost here and now. And I believe the figure that Raise the Rates is looking for based on that market basket measure is $1,500 a month.
Mm-hmm. That sounds about, as a basic bare minimum to scrape by, it would be very challenging in this city to live on $1,500 a month.
And yet that's like way more than double the current income assistance rate for a single person who is expected to work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And just to play devil's advocate, I mean, obviously I am in support of everyone having their basic needs met. I do feel like in a place like British Columbia, where there is so much wealth here, there's no excuse for people living in extreme poverty where they aren't able to have even food to eat. How might you respond to someone saying, well, people on welfare should just get a job? They're just freeloading. So why would we pay someone $1,500 a month? I mean, they're lucky to get $610.
Okay. So one thing I would say is it is a full-time job to try to survive if you are living in poverty, and that's a complete waste of people's human capacities, and that if people had a reasonable level of financial support just to meet their basic needs, their capacity would expand so much to work or contribute in whatever way makes best use of their gifts as human beings, right? But no one's gifts are best utilized by just obsessing about how you're going to scrape together enough food or, you know, having to, basically spend all your time surviving. So even on my, you know, welfare food challenge, which isn't at all similar to what people really experience because I have secure housing and I have all the kitchen gadgetry and whatever, I'm spending so much time working on this stuff. I'm spending so much time traveling from store to store to get the cheapest food, cutting the rotten parts off veggies, and, you know, making homemade broth and like all these things. So it's an enormous amount of work. So no one can actually just lift themselves out of poverty by working really hard in the current system because the basics just aren't there. If you don't have your health and you don't have your survival needs met, you can't do anything else. That's universal for all human beings. So anyone in that circumstance would have the same experience. I would also say that there's just, you know, a lot of stereotyping and discrimination against people living in poverty, which to me is the only reason I can think of that as a society we've tolerated the current system for as long as we have. You know, it's those attitudes that people are lazy or freeloading or whatever that, you know, contribute to this situation persisting. And I would also flag that a huge number of people on income assistance are kids. So there's about 38,000 kids in BC whose families are in, 35,000, sorry. Over 35,000 in BC whose families are on income assistance, and nobody would accuse them of like not working hard enough or doing something wrong. But in saying that, I want to be really cautious because I think there's a tendency to kind of have like a good poor people versus bad poor people dichotomy where like kids are okay because they're so innocent, but like let's blame their parents. But as I said, that's completely unreasonable and based on really discriminatory ideas about people in poverty.
Well, it's interesting. I saw, I think, was it a TED Talk or something about, they did an experiment in a classroom, I think it was a college classroom, where people had to throw something into the waste paper basket. And obviously the people who are closer to the waste paper basket had a better chance at hitting it versus the people at the back. But what happened is that the perception of people who were at the front, and this is just human nature, felt that they didn't really notice their advantage. They were kind of like, well, those people at the back of the room, well, that's their lack of skill.
Right.
Or their lack of willpower.
Totally.
But I got it in the basket because, you know, I'm better than them, basically.
Right. Yeah.
And that's just human nature. That does, I mean, it's not a bad person or a good person. It's just the way our brains are wired and the way we perceive the world. If we've only ever known affluence, some people can see how unfair it is, but our perception is just automatically skewed to kind of be like, well, I've worked hard for what I have.
Right.
So those people should work harder too.
Yeah. People don't tend to realize their experiences are not universal, and to make a lot of assumptions. And that's such a great analogy for understanding how that works. But I think it is totally possible by having these conversations to start shifting those ideas and have people start to go, oh, hey, like, hard work can take you really far when you have, like, you know, money to go to university and secure housing and plenty of food. And, you know, it, hard work can allow you maybe to survive if you don't have any of your basic survival needs met already.
Well, and like you said, that a lot of the ways that people do survive is they get involved in the sex trade, or they have to do some other criminal activity because they've got to eat.
Right. Yeah.
And then they're judged for committing crimes.
Right. And that's right. So, like, and that sort of brings me to another point, which is that often, and this was a point that was raised by Bill Hopwood, one of the organizers for Raise the Rates, at yesterday's press conference, that people keep saying, oh, there's no way to do it. We can't eliminate poverty. It's way too expensive. When in fact, the long range costs for our society of poverty are huge in terms of the healthcare system, largely because we know that there are terrible health consequences of living this way and not getting enough to eat and all the other factors of poverty year after year. And criminal justice system, because, as you said, people don't have options, and all kinds of other costs for our society. So it's very short-sighted to think that we can't afford to do anything about this.
But if we get rid of poverty, then all the people who are imprisoning the poor people will be out of jobs. So what are we going to do about that?
Yeah, I don't think it works that way. I'm not an economist, but I know that when everyone is not living in poverty, then people can contribute to the economy in different ways. I don't think that jobs suffer. People have enough money to spend on the things they really need. So then there's more demand to provide those needed services for everyone. So I just don't believe that for 1 minute.
Well, there's been talk about a minimum income for everyone, which happens in, there are some countries that do that, and it's through tax incentives and rebates and things like that, so that nobody actually has to go and apply for welfare. It's just that if they don't have enough money, if they didn't make enough money last year, their income gets topped up just automatically. I believe that they did that in a town in Manitoba for a few years, and I don't have the statistics, but the results were very positive. Healthcare costs went down hugely. Education test scores, things like that, improved. I mean, everybody's lives improved. And then the project was shelved again, and nothing happened.
Yeah, it was kind of an experiment in the 70s. I heard about that too. I think it was Dauphin, Manitoba. Yeah, there's a lot of talk of minimum income right now. And I think from conversations I've had with folks in Raise the Rates who really, you know, this advocacy and activism is their life, and they're the leaders in this, and they really know. I think it's a really complex issue because there are concerns about minimum income kind of being used as a way to, like, sneakily strip away other services, disability benefits and other things that people have access to when they are on income assistance and disability. So it depends how it's implemented. I'm sure that there would be a way of implementing it that would be great if it really meant that everyone could easily get their needs met. But I think it's just important to be alert to the fine print and how something like this is proposed and all the details of how it works, and to make sure it's not sort of giving with one hand and taking away with the other, mm-hmm. to the point that nothing really changes or it doesn't change significantly for people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can say that I know when I was in foster care, I had an experience where someone at school actually, I guess their father had some opinions about children living in foster care and how his tax dollars paid for my clothing and food.
Horrible.
And that child came to school and promptly told me about what a suck I was on society and how his father, you know, I should be grateful to them because I was only alive because of their tax dollars. So even there, I know that there is a lot of judgment about poverty in our society from people who have more. Mm-hmm. But also, I just want to point out that people who are experiencing poverty also have a lot of shame and self-judgment because of the way I'm generalizing, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. I know for myself that I have felt a lot of shame and wouldn't want to talk about where my money came from or anything like that, mm-hmm. because it was a source of shame, mm-hmm. which is not empowering, mm-hmm. to someone to do more and educate themselves, mm-hmm. more. Mm-hmm. It just adds more and more barriers.
For sure. I think with any kind of discrimination in society that's so pervasive and that runs so deep and that is rooted in a set of assumptions that people aren't even aware of. It's like kind of the air we breathe, you know? It can be a real struggle to not take it in on yourself if you're on the receiving end of that discrimination and internalize it. Yesterday, Joanne, who was one of the panelists at the press conference for the West Welfare Food Challenge, spoke about how she really does not feel shame because she is inspired by the community of people living in poverty around her, and she has done so much advocacy on it that she, you know, recognizes really because of life circumstances that people end up in these situations and that people are smart and capable and, you know, working so hard. But I think for lots of folks, it is definitely like a struggle to really feel that deeply, that there's nothing to be ashamed of. And I think it's the same with other types of, you know, identities or experiences that are stigmatized, like around mental health or having an eating disorder or whatever. So I'd mm-hmm. like to talk about it as publicly as I can.
Absolutely.
Like, that's, you know, it's not the same, obviously, but I think that's sort of part of the psychology of experiencing discrimination.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's, I don't think I'm as educated on this topic as you are, but it seems that it's the same as that classroom with people throwing, you know, we're constantly told that by, like, maybe just the suggestion from society, from the media, television, all of that, is that it's almost a weakness or a character flaw if there is some kind of barrier. Well, you should just overcome that barrier.
Right. Yeah, our society is so obsessed with just, like, individual effort and will and really doesn't look at the big picture and how factors are really stacked against people. Mm-hmm. And it's not just all about individuals. And also that we as a society have some responsibility, right? The responsibility isn't on the person who is struggling. It's on the people who are allowing that system to continue.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, like, I get the impression from people that I've spoken with who are against social services and things like that. And it seems like the perception is, yes, it might help people, but there's always going to be some people who will abuse the system and will take that livable income, let's say $1,500 a month. You could passably scrape by, mm-hmm. on $1,500 a month at living in Vancouver. So, you know, well, those people who have that might just not even bother getting a job because why would they? Mm-hmm. They can just live off the system. So I'm wondering how you would respond to that attitude.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, they definitely can't get a job in the current system. So if you're concerned about people getting jobs, one thing that you would know for sure is that the way things are set up now is like definitely not allowing people to get jobs. It's sort of like a punitive model. It's like, let's make life super miserable, super intolerable and dangerous for people. And in case that's like an incentive for them to just like miraculously lift themselves out of poverty. But it's such a obvious fact, at least to me, that you can't do much of anything if you don't have food and you don't have a roof over your head and you don't have clothing and you can't, like, how can you go to a job interview? You have no internet access. You have no data plan on your phone. You have no professional wardrobe. Like, so, I mean, clearly the way things are now is not helping people to get jobs, if that is the main concern. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that's really not helping people is all the discrimination and poor bashing stereotypes, which, you know, as you said, when those are internalized, like, causes so much emotional harm for people that's also not lifting them, like, it's also not empowering, right?
Well, so, a person can only hear that they're a loser or a sponge or whatever negative judgment so many times before they start to believe it.
Right. And although that's not, you know, universal, I think not everyone who lives in poverty believes those things about themselves, thank God.
Yeah.
I think, like, good for them, but it's a struggle for anyone to not start to believe what society tells you about yourself and that those messages are really toxic and definitely also not helping people get jobs if that's the main obsession. But I would really like to see the focus shift from getting jobs to, like, having your needs met, being healthy, not dying 10 years earlier, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that there's this obsession with getting jobs. Like, yeah, that would be great. But there are a lot of steps that have to happen first. And I don't think any human being should be reduced to their economic utility or, like, do you know what I mean? Like, we're not just employees, right? We're, like, mm-hmm. human beings first and foremost. And so, like, there are some pretty important human rights issues at stake other than just, like, are you or are you not employed?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's an interesting point that you bring up. It's difficult to contribute when you can't sleep because you're so worried you can't sleep.
Or you're so hungry.
You're so hungry, you're worried, you may not have a food over a roof over your head. Many of these lower income housing places have bugs, cockroaches, bed bugs are a really big issue in this city right now, which would prevent someone from sleeping as well. And then how easy is it to think clearly when you're malnourished and hungry?
Yeah. Another point that is really important to mention in the context of, like, people's ability to get jobs is one of the demands of Raise the Rates is to have a $10 a day daycare plan. And a huge reason why people can't have jobs and a huge reason why poverty is an issue that disproportionately impacts women is because women are still caregivers of kids way more than men, and we don't have affordable daycare in our province. So if you want to talk about people's ability to get jobs and more than that to be, you know, have some economic independence and all the benefits to our health and well-being and security that come from that, then it would be pretty great to have a daycare system in place. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, because, you know, women do disproportionately live in poverty because they tend to look for work that will fit in well with their family responsibilities, which still disproportionately fall to them. So it tends to be more casual, part-time contract work with no benefits, insecure work contracts that may end, and then they end up having to go on income assistance. And then, you know, that's one of the reasons why we see women living in poverty. And also, you know, work done by women is paid a lot less mm-hmm. than work done by men as well.
And I would imagine, you mentioned earlier in the hour also that that would contribute to staying in unsafe living situations, like with an abusive partner or something like that, because if you're not able to get a job or you're not able to earn enough income to be independent of that relationship because you have children and other responsibilities, right. It adds like a whole other layer. And then there's the victim blaming on top of that. Well, why don't you just leave?
Right. Why did you get into that relationship with that bad guy, untrustworthy guy, instead of looking at the guy who's perpetrating the violence? For sure. And it is true that women tend to be, they're less likely to be involved in living on the street, in street homelessness. So they're sort of underrepresented in homelessness counts and things like that, because it is so unsafe for them to be out on the street. If they have kids, they may be worried about the child protection system coming in and taking their kids. So they may avoid using homeless shelters and other services. And as you said, they end up living in really unsafe circumstances, going back to a relationship that they might not choose, that might actually be really dangerous for them, or in overcrowded, unsanitary, or otherwise dangerous conditions, to stay off the street at all costs, which is quite a dangerous place for women to be, especially if they have kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's such a big topic. An hour is not enough. Hang on one second here. I'm just trying to keep updated on the tweets. Biff Naked was it last year she did the food
challenge? She's done it, I think, more than once. Last year she wrote an awesome piece in the Georgia Strait about sort of how it's these poor bashing myths and stereotypes that allow this system to keep going, even though it's so clearly harmful and makes no economic or certainly no ethical sense.
It looks like she said, actually, here, raise the rates on Twitter, said, why do the welfare food challenge? And Biff Naked says, once people better understand poverty, they will feel outraged. And that's right. What we've been
make
talking about is until you've really felt that. And this is just a very, 1 week is a very short period of time.
Right. And I'm going in good health. And when it's over, I can take care of my health in whatever way I need to do. And every other aspect of my health is, and, you know, basic survival needs are completely met. Like, I was getting headaches yesterday, for example, because I was definitely eating a lot less than normal. And I was, like, taking ibuprofen. And I thought about the fact that, oh, you know, if I were actually on income assistance, that would be, like, a small bottle of ibuprofen is, like, 2 days worth of food. So I would not be doing that. Right.
Wow.
So, yeah, totally not at all similar to a real life experience, as I said.
And are you still working this week?
Yes. So I am. I'm just working 3 days a week at the moment, which is a change. I was working 4 days a week. And I'm actually like so grateful that this is one of my first weeks on the shorter week, because I'm like, oh my gosh, it's going to be so hard to work. Like, I'm going to be so, my kind of low blood sugary and my concentration's not going to be great. And I'm going to have to like think about what on earth I can bring into the office to eat, which is much more complicated than my normal lunch packing scenario. So yeah, like working 3 days a week is hard enough for me when I went into this in good health and have every other advantage. So for those who think, oh, people should get a job, why don't you try going to your own job? Inadequately nourished, which is only a start of what people really experience, and see how you do and if that changes anything for you.
Yeah. Sleep on the street or in a tent for a week with not enough food, no ibuprofen, not enough money to take the bus to get to work.
Right. Yeah.
And I would imagine even laundering clothes.
I mean,
that's an expense right there.
Yeah, definitely.
So even if you are blessed enough to have something to wear, how are you going to make sure it stays clean? That cuts into the food budget.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's like trade-offs of things that no one should ever, things that are essential, right? Like, it's like, am I going to have clean clothes, or I'm going to like eat a little bit more? That is not a choice anyone should have to make.
So there is a petition, raisetherates.org, if you want to get involved there and find out more information. And I'm just wondering, Alana, as you mentioned earlier, no one should have to rely on charity or the fortune of charity, because at the food bank, I mean, what you get is kind of a roll of the dice. And
right.
They're very... short in short supply these days.
Yeah, for sure.
So what can we do as people who are privileged to have their basic needs met? How can we help people living in poverty?
Well, I think, you know, in the system we live in now, food banks are essential, sadly. Food banks were started in 1982, I believe, as just like a temporary measure. Well, 34 years later, it looks like there's nothing temporary about it and people can't survive without them. But that's not adequate, right? So, I mean, I would never suggest that people not donate to food banks. I think that's really important, and to donate cash so that people can, so that fresh produce and stuff can be made available instead of just like Kraft Dinner over and over again. But also to advocate for the change you want to see, like, so that that kind of stopgap measure isn't something people have to rely on. So make poverty an election issue. Talk to people in your life about it. Write a letter to the editor. Write to your elected representatives to let them know what this means to you and why it's unacceptable. I think, you know, sometimes we get frustrated by what politicians do or don't do, but if there's a major cultural shift and a shift in the conversation, a lot of people start caring about this issue, there will be political, like, the, you know, our leaders will respond to that. And the provincial election, of course, is coming up in May, I believe. So, yeah, ask when you go to, if you go to hear your candidates speak, ask them what they plan to do about this, and find out what the party's platforms are and ask them to commit to some really significant change, not just like teeny tiny incremental change that doesn't fix the underlying problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank Alana Prochek for being here to talk about the Welfare Food Challenge. Again, we did request that someone receiving social assistance be a participate in this interview, and because of the barriers of even getting in touch or getting here because of the cost of bus fare and all of that, we were unable to do that in such a short period of time because apparently my show isn't big enough to
It's fine, I'm just teasing. Up yeah. Next in just a moment here on CITR is Parts Unknown with DJ Chris Horrific. And but yeah, like, let's keep this conversation going. This is now the fifth year of the Welfare Food Challenge, I believe.
Hopefully the last.
Hopefully.
Because they're reducing the food budget year by year, and pretty soon no one's going to want to do it to reflect the increase of cost of living.
Yeah, in 2012, the weekly budget was $26.
Right.
And now it is $18. And I think that that's a pretty generous
estimate. Right, and that's what I've been hearing from folks who are on income assistance, that, like, yeah, right, like, you're lucky if you can get that much. So in a sense, they're making it pretty easy for the challenge participants.
One Twitter follower following the Welfare Food Challenge mentioned that he lives on $40 a month of food, which is $10 a week rather than 18. He says that is luxurious.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine how challenging that must be. And then with children and their brain development and mm-hmm.
and a lot of parents, usually single moms, statistically scrimping on their own food to make sure their kids can eat a little bit more mm-hmm. and the harms that has for their health as well. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then the costs of the healthcare costs associated with that, as we know, nourishment and stress, lack of nourishment and stress cause all kinds of health problems. And if we're going to have a social health system, which we are so blessed to have, that just adds costs right there. Mm-hmm. And even if we were living somewhere where we didn't have universal health care, I mean, just the cost of having people on the street and the services that requires, like the policing and the prison system and the criminal justice system, all of that. I mean, if we are... Obviously, I'm looking at this from a compassionate point of view, mm-hmm. but if you want to look at it from a bottom line dollars and cents point of view, it's actually going to save us all money, too.
Right. So no matter which way you look at it, we know what we need to do.
It's just unacceptable. Yeah. So, raisetherates.org if you want more information about that. And Alana, before we close, I'm wondering what you'd like to leave us all with.
Oh, my goodness. to please continue the conversation and realize that nothing is inevitable about this situation. As I said before, and this is a kind of tagline that comes from Raise the Rates, I don't take credit for this, poverty is a political choice that our society has made, and it can change, and it has to change. So go out there and demand the change in whatever way makes sense to you.
Thank you so much, Alana, for being on the show today. And thank you for listening. I know this was a little bit different than what we normally talk about, but I just feel like it is so important. And I know everyone listening to this show who is a regular listener has the attitude of when one of us suffers, we all suffer. And I think that experiencing this firsthand for just even a short period of time is so valuable to even get a small glimpse at what it might be like. So thank you for taking this on, Alana. Thank you for your time. And thank you for listening. I want to send you lots of love. Have a wonderful week. And let's all be grateful for the food that we have and the,
if we have it,
the devices that we have. And yes. So thank you so much. Lots of love. Namaste.